Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for watching. The most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel on the internet. First on the docket today, it only takes one person to ruin it for everyone. And in the Suzanne Morphew case, that's right, it took 1,100. Next, the news media wants the names of the jurors in the Derek Chauvin matter. Do you think that they should be able to remain anonymous? A Murdoch investigation update, a principal on the prowl, when the Castle Doctrine doesn't quite work out, a dumb criminal update, and then finally our contestant for the dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. This is Crime Talk, and my name is Scott Reich. Thanks for watching. Now, if you haven't done so already, please hit that subscribe button as well as that little bell so that you get to receive notifications of when we go live or put up new content. And you think, well, why would I want to do that? Scott puts out a video every day. I know it's here. Yes, but you're going to go watch it, and you are going to receive notifications of when we go live. Although we do it every Tuesday night, you never know. Sometimes news breaks and we have to talk about it. All right, first on the docket. It only takes one person to ruin it for everyone. I'm sure your parents have told you that, right? It's always that one guy that takes it just a little too far. Well, in the Suzanne Morphew case, it was 1,100 people. Let me explain. As you may recall, the preliminary hearing for Barry Morphew in regards to the allegations of first-degree murder regarding the death and disappearance of his wife, Suzanne Morphew, are scheduled to begin August 9th, and it's set for 4 days. It's broken up on August 9th and 10th, and then August 23rd and 24th. Well, the court held a hearing last time in regards to some matters, and guess what? It was live-streamed. Now, that was not considered a critical stage of the proceedings, and the court granted expanded media coverage. And I don't want to sound like a I told you so kind of guy, but in this particular case, I'm going to say I told you so. I would have loved to have streamed on our channel the hearing and the proceedings. However, the court said you cannot basically stream and rebroadcast this hearing. It's only for viewing. Well, not only at the last hearing did 1,100 people sign in to watch, but there were comments. And as the court noted, that many of the comments were inappropriate, okay? And the court has a job and a responsibility to focus and make sure that they're listening to the evidence, making legal rulings based upon the evidence, their lack thereof, and the arguments of counsel. Well, now, if it's live streamed and people are making inappropriate comments, the court has to deal with that as well. Court doesn't have the time nor the resources to do that. And the court pointed out in its order stating that they're not going to live stream these proceedings is that, as noted, there were 1,100 people. And in the chat feature, many of the comments the court described as completely inappropriate. The court further notes that, oh, and this is my favorite. And because you say, why, Scott, is this your favorite? Well, remember when I said, you know, people, I'm watching and I watched the entire proceedings, but I can't rebroadcast it because there's an order from the court that says you can't rebroadcast it. And as an officer of the court, I have to follow the court's orders, even if I don't like them. Well, a lot of people, even against my advice, I wasn't giving it as an attorney, as because I wasn't engaging in an attorney-client relationship, but I said, you people need to stop doing this. You could be held in contempt. And some people live stream the proceedings. And the court took note of that. The court is aware that despite a prohibition on recording and rebroadcasting, the proceedings were recorded and rebroadcast. Yep, those people ruining it for everyone. The fact that it would be the court broadcasting the proceedings and not the media does not alter the court's thinking. The same rationale applies. The court notes that our governor here in the state of Colorado has basically said there is no longer a pandemic and therefore we can have public proceedings. So what does that mean? Well, the preliminary hearing, proof, evident, presumption, great. That's to see, is the evidence so great against Barry Morphew that he should have a zero bond, no bond hold? Well, the court needs to be able to pay attention and not have to worry about people rebroadcasting because of their failure to follow simple instructions. God, that just drives me bonkers. Really, it does. I would love to do things, but yes, there are still rules, ladies and gentlemen. And those who rebroadcast it, I like some of you. I really do. But you ruined it. You ruined it. Now we can't watch it. And what does that have to mean for you? Well, it means we're not going to get to see it there. But don't worry. Crime Talk has a solution. You've heard us talk about Miss Julie. That's right. Works next to Frank, the hardest working man in show business. Well, she's going down and going to attempt to observe, as a member of the public slash media, the proceedings in Chaffee or Chaffee County, depending on how you pronounce it. That's right. So thank you all for ruining it. Now I get to expend great expense sending Miss Julie to do what I could have done from my office, but for somebody's inability to follow simple instructions. You know what my drill instructor used to say? That's right. Failure to follow simple instructions demonstrates an inability to accept larger responsibility. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. All the court said was, don't rebroadcast. You did it. You ruined it for everyone. Next on the docket, some people in the news media want to get all the information, specifically the names and addresses and telephone numbers of the jurors in the George Floyd Derek Chauvin trial. The court, Judge Cahill, put these jurors' names and contact information under seal because he was concerned about, obviously, somebody harassing or even harming a potential juror. And that is obviously a legitimate concern, I would agree, when the trial is going on. But the news media makes some pretty good arguments in their briefs, and they even cite now-deceased former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And it states, and I think it's worth noting, says, as explained in greater detail, identification of jurors is a central feature of our criminal justice system, not a flaw or an afterthought, and the common refrain among laypersons that they, quote, they did their duty, now leave them alone, end quote, ignores the full scope of a juror's responsibility. Simply put, our criminal justice system asks jurors not only to leave their jobs and their families, evaluate often heartbreaking evidence, and make difficult life-altering decisions, but also to do so publicly, by name, and to then find the personal fortitude to withstand the scrutiny that results as the public tries to understand and learn from the verdict. As Justice Scalia wrote in a concurring opinion, that the names on a petition must be disclosed to the public despite fears of threats and intimidation. There are laws against threats and intimidation, and harsh criticism, short of unlawful action, is a price our people have traditionally been willing to pay for self-governance. Requiring people to stand in public for their political acts foster civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. Wow. Good stuff there, right? Sounds like it was written by a lawyer. Well, it was a very intelligent United States Supreme Court justice. And it makes sense. Yes, during a trial, you do not want to have jurors' names out there, particularly in a high-profile case, because you don't want them tampered with, intimidated in any way. But once the verdict is done, I think the courts are going to have to release that information. We know of at least three jurors that have already spoken publicly about their time as a juror, their decision, and the deliberation process. And when you are on a jury, that's one of the reasons why we do trials in person, right? How many keyboard warriors out there that think they are pretty smart and brave behind the keyboard and that screen? It's another thing to actually say it or do something to somebody in public. That's right. That's why we have trials in public. That's why jurors have to show up in public. That's why witnesses have to show up and be subject to cross-examination so that you can't just make an allegation and go away. And guess what? If there was juror misconduct, we need to know about it. Not particularly as it relates just to the Derek Chauvin matter. The matter's been tried. It can go on. But for future cases, we need to know a way to learn from it and prevent it in the future. So we'll keep you advised as to how the court's going to rule on this. Judge Cahill is not going to allow it. I don't think he's going to change his mind. I don't think he's going to think that enough time has passed. And in this particular case, the appellate courts are going to have to decide. Next on the docket, a quick case regarding the Murdoch homicides down in South Carolina. Now, as I told you the other day, I lived in this part of South Carolina when I was stationed in the Marine Corps. I still have a home in South Carolina down in Beaufort County. I love that area. Nicest people in the world. I'm telling you, nicest people in the world. People in the South, they have something that a lot of people don't have in other parts of the country. It's called manners. It's amazing. Well, anyway, I've talked to some people that I know down there, and they said, yes, this is the talk of the town. The Murdoch family, obviously very prominent there in South Carolina. Their family had served as solicitor or a district attorney in this area for 85 years. People say nothing was done unless the Murdochs gave it their stamp of approval. And I told you about the commentary that I was reading the other day that basically said if no one's ever charged in relationship to the Murdoch homicide of Paul and Maggie, his mother, that a Murdoch would have had to have been involved. That's what a lot of people think. I mean, this is a case where Paul Murdoch was charged in regards to the case of Mallory Beach, where she died basically because Paul Murdoch allegedly ran his boat into a bridge and she was thrown from the boat and passed away. A lot of confusion, a lot of influence being exerted early on in the investigation, which stalled and possibly even tried to put somebody else behind the wheel of the boat. Then we have another situation where a young man was killed, Stephen Smith, and it just didn't make a whole lot of sense that they basically said he must have been hit by a car when there's no evidence to support that. And then, coincidentally, when they're doing the investigation as it relates to the murders of Paul and Maggie Murdoch, they seize that particular car and other information based upon what they found at the house. Then we have the allegation of the maid who is paid in a wrongful death case. I mean, why would you pay somebody being sued for a wrongful death if somebody was just simply injured on the job? Makes no sense. And all that stuff is sealed. So a lot of talk and speculation. I wanted to give you an update on the case because, one, I think it's absolutely fascinating, just given the perceived power and influence that this family has. It would make you think that they could have a lot of enemies, a lot of people of interest that the police would want to talk to. And as of to date, since the homicides going back to early June of this year, no person of interest identified, nobody charged. Makes you wonder if maybe that person writing that commentary who said no one will be charged if a Murdoch was involved. I don't like to engage in a whole lot of speculation, but apparently the people down there in South Carolina know better than I do. So we'll keep you updated on new information as it becomes available. All right. Next on the docket, a principal on the prowl, and not in a good way. I don't want to sound like a cynic. Maybe after 26 years of practicing criminal law, sometimes that's where you get. Sometimes you think there are not many good people left in the world, and then you hear about a good story and you think, all right, that just restored my faith in humanity. And then you find another case like this. Well, the Chandler Police Department in Arizona, Chandler, sound familiar? What case were they investigating? That's right. Anyway, Victor Zamora, he's been charged. He was a school principal and been charged now with sexual misconduct after a 16-year-old said that Mr. Zamora attempted to recruit him to the school where he worked. There were several incidents and then allegations of sexual misconduct. Now, I know there are a lot of good people that work with kids, okay? They're doing God's work. But as a general rule, most people love their kids, even have stepchildren. You love them like your own, right? But hanging out with other people's kids is probably so low on my want to do list. Maybe it's just me, maybe because I'm getting older, I don't know. But I wouldn't want to do it, okay? And I've said this before, right? And not, you know, I don't want to get in trouble here, but you often wonder, gee, why are so many people that work around these kids getting in trouble for doing misconduct against these children? Well, if you have a certain proclivity, don't you think that you'd maybe want to be around those type of people if that's what you wanted to do? Think about it. Not saying everybody that works at, I don't know, Chuck E. Cheese or in a school principal or teacher position is doing any sort of sexual misconduct. Maybe they just love teaching. But you gotta wonder, people, why are some of these people here? And you gotta check their backgrounds. So Mr. Zamora, he's gonna be in custody for a while. He has $1 million bond, and oh, apparently his visa has expired. So he was in the United States illegally, and that's why the prosecutors believe that he is a flight risk if he is released. Poor Mr. Zamora. He is obviously given the presumption of innocence, but you gotta wonder, oh, that's right. He also confessed to the inappropriate conduct as well. We will follow that case as information becomes available. Please go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for a background subscription service. You'll be happy you did. If there's anyone out there you were ever curious about what was in their background, now is the time to do it. If you're going to get involved with somebody, now is the time to do it. When you go to crimetalksearch.com, you put in the name, literally millions of public records are searched and a report is generated. And it's going to give you a report. If they have multiple social media accounts, you're going to find it. If they have multiple phone numbers, multiple email addresses, it's going to be found. And more importantly, you're going to get information regarding criminal history. Hopefully the person you're searching has none whatsoever. But if it's there, it's going to be found. You're going to get everything you'd want to know, whether you're going into business or whether you're going into a personal relationship. You're going to be able to find out the information you want to know. So go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up today. You'll be happy you did. Do you remember yesterday we talked about the Castle Doctrine? And in a nutshell, what this really means is that if you're in your home, you have a right to defend yourself if you believe that somebody is there to cause you harm. And usually, if somebody comes in and they have no reason to be there and you shoot them dead, guess what? You get a free pass. It's called the Castle Doctrine. Well, we also talked about that you got to make sure people cross the plane of the doorway. And they have to kind of be uninvited. So meet two people here. Emily Strzok. She was now facing charges of attempted murder because it turned out the intruder that came into her home was somebody that she had previously been involved in an intimate relationship with. She stated that the man forced her way into her apartment, assaulted her and another adult male who was in the home at the time, and therefore she shot him. Now, the suspect, or the victim in this particular case, survived after being shot. Another adult male, Kevin Wharton, was in the apartment, and he has been charged as well. So it turns out, based upon that initial information, the police did not have enough to go on. The police at the time asked if they could, in fact, see the cell phone of Miss Strunk. And she said, yeah, no, I think I want to talk to a lawyer because there may be some things on there that could be taken into consideration and maybe being taken out of context. Well, she did herself well, but guess what? There's always two ways to skin a cat. And in this particular case, the police were able to obtain some further information. They also obtained some video outside of her apartment where it looks like Miss Strunk allegedly was the initial aggressor and then led somebody into the apartment. So, Castle Doctrine, in a nutshell, ladies and gentlemen, you have to be in your home, basically minding your own business, perhaps asleep. An intruder comes in, you usually have a right, but always check with the laws in your own state to use deadly force to protect yourself. You can't invite people over and then say, oh, by gosh, they were coming in. I didn't know who they were. And then use deadly force. That's a problem. That's called premeditated murder, or at least attempted murder, if you were as unsuccessful as allegedly Miss Strunk was in this particular case. So hopefully that clears it up. Good example here of just don't try to create a situation where it looks like you're trying to get rid of somebody and you invite them over to the house. That is not something the Castle Doctrine is going to cover. Next on the docket, an update regarding a previous dumb criminal contestant winner. That's right. Remember Mr. Elmo? Tickle Me Elmo? We've had a couple of them. But Kevin Van Leuven, who was working as a home inspector at the time, was caught on video. Here's a little screenshot of him in the home with the Tickle Me Elmo. Well, he confessed to maybe placing Tickle Me Elmo over various parts of his anatomy and pleasuring himself with the Tickle Me Elmo, not being aware that there was video on there. Well, now Mr. Van Leuven believes that his statements should be suppressed because he was actually under arrest, and therefore his admissions that he had unzipped his pants and began pleasuring himself with the Tickle Me Elmo toy should be suppressed and not be admitted at trial. Obviously, they still have the video, but it would be a little more difficult for the prosecution to prove, perhaps, without his confession. When the officer, one of the greatest lines that you probably had to be there for the court hearing, when asked the police officer whether evidence was seized, the officer responded, quote, "We collected Elmo and took Elmo in," end quote. Collecting those things of evidentiary value. Now, you have to also feel a little sympathy here for Mr. Van Leuven. He spent 5 months in custody before he was able to make bond. And here's the picture of the house, if Frank puts that up, that shows the house of the great sexual assault of Tickle Me Elmo. All right, next on the docket, a dumb criminal contestant that frankly is worthy of a second chance. Nathan Denzuka was a previous dumb criminal contestant, but he deserves a second chance because this guy is an overachiever and he has set records. And so frankly, maybe we didn't vote him as the dumb criminal contestant winner of the week last time, but maybe this time he will. Why, you wonder? Because he has now kind of officially gone into the record books with the highest recorded BAC. Now, Mr. Denzuka, I'm going to go on a limb here, has a drinking problem. He has a very high tolerance of alcohol to such an extent that his BAC recorded was a 0.778. Ladies and gentlemen, most people would die at a 0.3. He is a 0.7. That's like pickled unless you are a raging functional alcoholic. And remember, the legal limit is 0.08. 0.08, and he is 0.7. Huge numbers. Mr. Danzuka's BAC now officially takes the record. There was a previous case recorded by a woman in Oregon with a 0.720, and then another woman in South Dakota of 0.708. So, Mr. Danzuka, for officially becoming the highest BAC ever recorded, you deserve another shot at the dumb criminal contestant of the week. Now, Mr. Danzuka, I wish you well. I really do. Clearly, drinking problem. I don't think many people would deny that. And hopefully you go to jail and you stay clean and sober and are not making a bunch of jailhouse hooch while you're in custody. Use this time wisely. That is our advice. That was our recommendation, Mr. Danzuka. And I say that with a little bit of skepticism because, like I said, maybe I've mentioned this before, I've had clients that have gone to prison and never had a drug problem and came out addicted. So you can usually get whatever you want in custody. I know it's hard to believe. You hope it doesn't work that way, but it does. Mr. Danzuka, you are the dumb criminal contestant of the day. And if you are the winner, that's right, here's a coffee mug. Coffee mug being the key term, coffee. Not any unknown alcoholic beverages, Mr. Danzuka. All right, have a great day. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.